Hey guys, just a quick note to let you know that this episode on the philosophical concept of just war theory was recorded a few weeks before the Israeli-Hamas war began. We know wars and armed conflict happen, unfortunately, all the time, but wanted you to know that the freshness of this new war and the timing of the release of this episode is completely coincidental. Thanks, and on with the show.
All right, everybody, welcome to Open Door Philosophy. This week, we are trying for the first time to go live on camera, so this is pretty wild. With me is Derek Parsons.
Hey, everybody.
And Taylor Jones.
Hey, y'all.
And I'm Andrew. I guess I'm moderating this week's conversation. This is so wild to see y'all with the recording. Yeah.
It is.
We tried it out a few days ago just to see what it would look like and, upgrade our cameras and such. But this is pretty wild. Anyways, enough about that. How are y'all doing today? Taylor?
I'm good. I feel like I've said this like the last three episodes, but this is such the heart of the semester when everything is so busy. And I feel like I did not have a single break all week and wrote so much and I have so many exams. So I will be happy when it gets to be like a kind of chill part of the semester, like in the next week or two. I feel like it should slow down, but good. Busy, but good. What about you guys?
So my students this week told me that when you say chill, you do this. Teenagers.
Is this a thing?
Parsons, do this. Say, chillin'. I'm like chillin'? Like hang loose? Like this is what it meant in the 80s. Anyway, so everything's chill for you, Taylor. I'm great. Mm-hmm. This is the second week in a row I don't have any essays to grade, so I'm feeling free as a bird. Mm. And we're recording this a few weeks out. By the time this episode's air, I will have experienced a blissful week of fall break.
Nice.
And the lows for weather next, 7 days from now, are going to be in the 50s. So I'm very excited about that. I know.
It's even nice this morning.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's coming for you too, Taylor. Anyway, all is well with me. How about you, Andrew?
I'm good. I got a nice 8 hours of sleep, which is new. So that's always something to celebrate. And the rest of today, so I have a very hard deadline from my editor for this journal publication. We've been in the editing stages, and this will be due sometime in the next week. So I've been really slow with my editing. Edited about 6 paragraphs out of 30 or 40. So today will be the day to work on this. I'm not looking forward to it, but it's always a fun time, So we'll see how long this takes.
Nothing like a deadline. Is this your paper on love?
Yep. So it's been tossed around. It's been in the editing stages from, I have an editor, which is wild.
What's that like?
It's really strict. More than I would have thought.
Interesting.
They were upset with me for using politically incorrect language.
That's new.
I don't think it was that bad. So I think in my article, I talked about a mentally able adult, and they did not like that.
Yeah,
which
okay.
I guess makes sense, but
sure.
I don't. What's the opposite of a disabled adult? I would think that would be mentally able, but I can see how that would be. They'd prefer some other kind of language.
What did they say? What did your editor say?
Yeah.
They had no suggestions, just a different.
Oh, they're just like, don't do this.
Yeah. Just use a different term. So,
okay.
That's good.
Lot.
Yeah. I don't know. And then I got yelled at for formatting issues, citing things wrong.
Mm.
I feel bad for my students or for other students too whenever I see these comments. But it's been really good. It's been good. So I'm excited for that. I'll let y'all know when that's finalized and published.
Yeah. That's cool. Episode was that we did?
It was
65 or something.
64. Yeah, 64, 65. Yeah, so give that a listen if you don't know what we're talking about, but it should be good. It's a massive overhaul from what we talked about, honestly, because I got I got the comments from the editor about a week after we recorded that, which would have been nice to know. And so that'll be cool. I'll share that with y'all.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyways.
Today's, are we episode 68, right?
It's 68 today.
Yeah. Episode 68.
We're going to be talking about just war theory.
Mm-hmm. Something I know nothing about.
This is my 20th episode.
Taylor, wow. Congratulations.
This is awesome.
Episode.
Yeah. We should have some kind of celebration sound or something here.
Yeah, some like some champagne emojis popping on the screen or something around Taylor's head. Anyway, all right. 20 episodes with Taylor.
Yeah.
You know, so this is something funny. I don't want to steal the spotlight. I'll bring it back to you. But so for my work, one of the benefits is some kind of legal plan, you know. And so I was looking at that yesterday, and I saw that I can do my will and testament and like all of that good stuff online with them. And so I was filling it out, and then afterwards I got some email from them, and it was like, congratulations, you've done your will and last testament. And then it was a image of champagne and popping. I was like, this is kind of morbid.
Everything's anyway, so congratulatory online. I love it when I like pay a bill. It's like, congratulations, you paid your electric bill.
Like really? I don't know. Anyways, Taylor. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I like that they do that on Canvas, though. When you submit an assignment, you get confetti. It's that's like, congratulations.
Does that happen? I'm familiar with it on the user side of things. Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's the worst.
No, it's the best. Because it's like validation of like, I completed it.
No.
Did it.
Yes.
Anyways, Taylor, what's been your number one biggest, your like favorite moment on Open Door Philosophy? 20 episodes is something to celebrate. So what's been the favorite?
Ooh, I don't know. I think, that's such a good question. I've just really enjoyed all of it, honestly. I think it's so fun that we get to talk about like all of these different topics and kind of come from all of our different perspectives, things that I wouldn't have necessarily studied at this point we've gotten to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something super cool. When we were talking about this podcast for the first time, that's something that I was really excited about, having the ability to learn a lot more about philosophy and adding you on, Taylor. Honestly, it's been such a cool experience to learn more about stuff you're interested in, because I think we've said this before, but I don't know if we've done it on recording. We all have such different interests in philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so being able to talk with y'all every other week about things, it's super cool. So that's been great.
It's been interesting to watch you change, actually, Andrew, over the last 3 years. I don't know exactly. I can't know exactly because, you know, the problem of other minds. But when we started this, I think you and my common interests were fairly aligned. And they still are, I think. But you've gone off on a bit of a different direction these last 3 years. And it's changed over time, which is totally normal. Mine has changed over time as well. It'd be interesting to kind of track that. But it'll be interesting too, Taylor, to see how you change over the next couple of years, especially doing a lot of political philosophy, which it's I know nothing about, which is why I'm really interested to today's episode. I mean, I'm just riding the coattails here. I'm going to be learning from you guys. I know enough just war theory to be dangerous, you know, but like a lotto scratch off ticket, you know, my knowledge is about as thick as one of those scratch off things. And then you realize when you scratch it off, there's nothing underneath it. So I just, I mean, I know what just war theory is, but I know none of the arguments. So anyway, I'm looking forward to today.
That's going to be super cool. I'm super excited about it. At least I think it'll be a good episode. Taylor, you were the person who suggested this topic, I believe. So why were you, what was the idea behind that for you?
So last semester, I took a class called International Relations, or like Fundamentals of International Relations. And my professor is also the sponsor for our chapter of Alexander Hamilton Society, which is like a political science oriented society where they have like different speakers come in. In 1 week, the speaker was talking about just war theory, and he had just published a book on it. And we spent a lot of that semester too talking about when wars are justified and like different conflicts and why they happen. So I thought it'd be interesting that something that we could talk about, since that's kind of outside of what we usually do.
It's interesting that I think, and well, I mean, it makes sense thinking about it in terms of international relations, but this is when I learned about just war theory, or the little that I know, it was also in the context of international relations, which I think makes sense.
Oh, sure. Yeah. God, I bet that Alexander Hamilton Society was totally dorking out when the musical came out.
No doubt.
I bet those meetings were insufferable.
That's probably when it got popular.
It might be.
Yeah.
They probably thought it was a musical club.
Is your like a society's slogan like not throwing away my shot or something like that?
I don't think so. I mean, it could be out there somewhere, but yeah, I don't know.
I want to be in the room where it happens. You know, something like that. There's some merch potential there.
Yeah. Definitely.
Well, anyway, before
do you want to do that email?
Yeah, let's do it before we get into the episode. We have an email from someone who wrote into our contact at opendoorphilosophy.com, right? That's the email.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That is the I got email. It right for once. Okay. This guy named Justin from Ireland sent us an email discussing one of our episodes, episode 38, which I believe was the teleological episode where we discussed the teleological argument for the existence of God. And so I'll read it out and I want to get y'all's responses to it. Although it's addressed kind of to me, I think it's addressed to all of us as well. So, and it's an important question. So I'll just get into it. So Justin writes, "Greetings from Ireland, where I'm listening to your podcast and currently on episode 38. Very enjoyable. I have a degree in philosophy myself from nearly 25 years ago, but only getting back into some study as a hobby in recent months, with the podcast being a great way to reintroduce myself to the key concepts. One question I think might be of interest. What role does personal and unconscious bias play in searching for truth philosophically? I know that Andrew is a Catholic, for example, and discussions on evolution in episode 37 were influenced by that fact for sure. And that's okay. But is the role of the philosopher to be totally open-minded, or is it okay to approach any subject with your own perspective as a starting point? I think that could generate a good discussion. Thank you very much, Justin, for writing into the podcast. This is such a great question. Let me throw it to y'all before I talk about it.
This is a great question. I'm of the opinion that you can't start anywhere but from yourself with philosophy. It's impossible to avoid. And I think that's what a lot of philosophy has attempted to address over the years, especially in ancient times, to try to be as objective as possible. That's where that rationality comes in, to try to acknowledge what your biases are and be critical of those biases and then move on from there. But I also think that your particular bias is also important. So I don't know, I'll let you guys keep on going with that. Taylor, what do you think?
Yeah, I am very much aligned with Mr. Parsons. I think I may have talked about this like the last two episodes as well. The view from nowhere. Isn't that Thomas Nagel?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Parsons talked about it way back when I was in high school. And that's always kind of stuck with me, that there is no view from nowhere and there's no way to take your perspective out of the equation, at least when studying philosophy. So it's important to like acknowledge where you are and think about how that actively influences how you think about things, but there's nothing wrong with like having a perspective to come from. It's just kind of what you do with it, in my opinion.
Yeah, Nagel's, I mean, paraphrasing, his quote is basically, yeah, a view from nowhere is impossible. There's always a view from somewhere. But of course, that's the challenge, right?
Well, I'll take a surprisingly third party approach, I guess, to this. First off, I'll say, I think this question is really good. I mean, it's an essential question when we're looking at philosophy. It's impossible to be a really good philosopher without examining your unconscious biases when you're coming to the equation. And that's, I think, one of the beauties about good logical thinking, as everyone knows, I'm a fan of. I think for certain questions, you can come to the table with a rather open mind. I'm not sure what those are, but maybe things that we don't know much about. For this question, for episode 37, I listened to a little bit about it for, actually, it was episode 37. I don't know. Maybe episode 37 was the ontological argument for the existence of God. It was during our God series, this question.
The God series.
Yeah, it was the God series. That sounds really great. I'm not exactly sure what I said, because I think the Catholic Church doesn't even, I mean, they don't have a position on evolution. It's not a, they accept it, they don't deny it. And so they really have no stance. So my Catholicism, maybe my outlook on it might have shaped it, but I don't believe the earth was created in 7 days. I'm not exactly sure. I do believe in some kind of evolution. So I'm not sure exactly what I said there. But for sure, I mean, I think it's very evident. I talk about it probably 100 times per episode, how my own viewpoints influence how I think about philosophy. And I think a large part of that is because how I came to philosophy was even from a philosophy of religion approach. And so that's how I think about a lot of philosophy, its relationship to the divine or to creation. And I think that that's important for me as just grounding, like Mr. Parsons and Taylor said. I don't know to what extent you can even approach a question without any bias, but I think you have to approach subjects that you're studying, maybe not at first, but down the line, you have to look at your biases for that.
Mm-hmm.
I've been reading this Elon Musk biography lately, which we have to talk about some week. I just finished it last night, actually.
Oh, did you? Okay, yeah. Good for you.
But a key question in his, at least in his engineering, like when he was building SpaceX and Tesla, the key question was like, what do the laws of physics say that is possible? And then what's just our like expectation around those? Like we think mm-hmm. that we think that X is impossible, but is it really impossible? We think that, you know, we have to use aluminum to build a spaceship. Why can't we use another type of material? And I think that's like just a really good question mm-hmm. for philosophy. We've talked about the relationship between science and philosophy. And I think this is a really great point. There's always room to drill down and look at our first principles approach when we're approaching a question. What do y'all think? Mm-hmm. I kind of rambled for a minute.
I think that's absolutely right. I also think you got to be careful when you're talking about Elon Musk and saying X. X is not possible because X is possible. He made Twitter into X. Very possible. But yeah, no, that's all very right. We do have these particular viewpoints that we think is the way it's done. For instance, if you go back to Elon Musk and talk about building spaceships out of aluminum or whatever. Yeah, and that's an important part of critical thinking, right? Isn't it? That we can ask questions of things that are assumed, that we like, this is the way it's done. It's the way it's always been done. This is the way we'll continue to do it. You got to ask questions of that sometime. And that has a lot to do, I mean, things like traditions is another big thing. That's always like, this is the way we've always done it. And if you're not open to be able to discuss those things, the way we do it may very well be good. But also when it comes to changing things or a need for change, yeah, you got to be able to question those things.
Yeah, I think the important distinction that we're all kind of in agreement that your perspective is good and valuable, but you can't let that get in the way of having an open mind. Like, I think there's room for both of those things, that you can acknowledge your perspective and what's informed your perspective, whether that's your upbringing, like your parents' beliefs or your religion or your cultural values, but also keep space for new information, because not everything we believe is true, or we just haven't been exposed to things that we may agree with in the future. So keeping room for new information that could change our perspectives, I think, is valuable.
100%. But there also has to be some recognition by the good, you know, the good philosopher. That sounds like a TV show. You know, there always has to be some recognition by the good philosopher. I mean, that just sounds like Aristotle. That's what they used to call him, right? Mm-hmm. There always has to be some recognition by the philosopher who's doing philosophy well, that you have to start from somewhere. I mean, mm-hmm. even with logic, right. You have to accept the premise that this is a system that works. Mm-hmm. There's been no proof that logic, I mean, this is where Russell failed, and this has been the philosophy of the past. I mean, the logical, mathematical logic in philosophy for the past 100 years has been trying to prove that logic doesn't need some kind of premise to stand upon, you know? Mm-hmm. And we've seen that just fails. We cannot prove logic as a fundamental truth, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be always some assumption that the key indicators are true. And so even in something like logic, which or math, and math is the same way, which we take to be some kind of universal truth that we can prove things off of, that itself requires some kind of fundamental acceptance of premises that are, mm-hmm. you know, just built upon acceptance.
Yeah.
And so if that is true, then in any type of philosophy or any type of thing that we form beliefs off of, there has to at least be some kind of fundamental acceptance from the beginning.
Hear, hear.
Yeah.
It's like axioms in mathematics and stuff.
Exactly. That's exactly, yeah. exactly right. And so I think we're all in agreement about this. Thank you so much, Justin, mm-hmm. for writing in with this great question. It was really good. Thank you.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. In fact, our previous two episodes were also based on questions from listeners. So thanks for sending those in, guys.
If you want us to discuss a question on Open Door Philosophy, you can email us at contact@opendoorphilosophy.com and we'll try to respond to those in the episodes if we can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or over on Instagram if you just have like a quick question that you want an answer from one of us.
That's right.
Yeah, one of ours came through Instagram. That's right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the most recent ones. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get started on this week's topic, I guess, for Just War Theory.
Nah, no. I'm good. Good to go. Although I'm looking at myself now that we're on camera, I'm looking at myself and
way too much.
You guys have your cool AirPods in. And I've got these, you know, muffins on my ears.
That was a conscious decision.
It was.
Yeah.
I'm not going to stop right now and go get my AirPods, but maybe next time.
All right, so let's talk about it. What is, when it comes to the first thing that we think about, let's not get into it. What is just war theory? What does it mean for a war to be just? I'll throw it to Parsons first, since he has the least exposure, then Taylor, then I'll talk about it.
So when I think of just war, I think of, so wars happen. That's a thing. And given that they happen, especially if you're considered the aggressor or you've made the first move, if you will, you want to have some reason for that. And it shouldn't be a bad reason, like we just want to acquire land. It should be some sort of reason that has moral value or merit, mm-hmm. right? And so when I think, especially back in the days when I taught history, I think really the first time I bring up just wars when we're talking about the Crusades and how those were justified. But that's, you know, without going further in depth, that's my sort of knee-jerk reaction to just war.
Yeah, that's great. What about you, Taylor?
I would pretty much agree with Mr. Parsons. I think it's the idea that we're asking a question of if there are any justified wars, and if they are, what justification do you need? Like, do you just need a rational justification of this country is a threat, so we have to neutralize the threat to us? Or do you need a moral justification? Like, this country is committing crimes against humanity towards its inhabitants, so we have to step in. And like, where do we draw that line? It was kind of an undercurrent in my international politics class, and we started talking about Thucydides in the Peloponnesian War. And I think that's a very interesting thought about just war, because Athens and Sparta did a lot of things that were morally deplorable, but they had justifications for them of some kind. Like, they made reasons up that they used to justify why they invaded other city states and conquered them and like ravaged the city. And I think just war kind of asks the question of, was that justified, or do you need a further justification?
Right. Because here's the deal. When we're talking about war, we're talking about killing people. Like, there's no way to get around that. And, you know, as far as morality goes, most people, almost all people, I would assume, agree that what we call murder is wrong. Murder is killing, and murder brings a moral dimension to the killing. So is there a way to justify killing other people through war? In other words, we're trying to sanitize it as much as we can, because, yeah, I mean, you can't avoid it when we're talking about war. We're talking about killing people.
For sure. And that area of discussing when is it right to kill other people, that's just one area of just war theory. Just war theory goes, I can think of at least three parts of just war theory. There's the first part, which is, when is it acceptable for a nation to go to war with another nation? Okay, so this is thinking country X and country Y. When is it okay for country X to go to war with country Y? When is it okay for them to use their resources to bomb them? And also, when is it acceptable for us to use negotiations and use soft power? Mm-hmm. and things of this nature. So I think that's part A. Then there's part B of just war theory, which is the most common kind of thought, which is how should parties act when they are in war? Okay. Maybe the first part is, when is it acceptable to use force? The second part is, okay, when we are using force, what kind of force is acceptable? And then there's the final part. And there's the final part, which is, how do we respond to another party after the war has taken place? Mm-hmm. So should we totally destroy them? Should we kind of help prop their economy back up? Should we give them resources to rebuild? Should we anything after we've killed the leaders who instituted the war? So I think those are the three, at least, big divisions in just war theory. Even now, there's the United Nations has concepts of when is it acceptable? There's jus ad bellum, which is, I think, the first part. When is it acceptable for countries to go to war? When is it acceptable for them to use it? There's jus in bello, which is the rules that dictate when is it acceptable for a country to, what kind of force is acceptable for a country to use. And then there's jus post bellum, which is the post-war kind of thoughts. And so these are dictated by the United Nations. And so this, I think, really brings us to an important concept, which we highlighted at the beginning of the episode. What underlines all of this, at least right now? And that's international law, this concept of international law. Taylor, do you have anything to say about what is international law? Is it real? Why is it important?
A little bit. I don't have a whole lot of exposure. We spend a little bit of time on international law and international institutions in the context of state sovereignty, that in like 1600s Europe, kind of early Enlightenment era, the idea of raison d'etat kind of rose up, the rationale of the state. And then throughout the following centuries, the idea of the state becomes really solidified. And then the idea of sovereignty, that a state should have absolute authority to be able to make decisions within its borders. So, for instance, France should be able to make decisions pertaining to France, and England shouldn't have anything to do with it. Germany shouldn't have anything to do with it. But where the UN today is concerned is what happens when a state is not fulfilling its duties as a state. So if that's their infrastructure for public resources is failing, should a state be able to step in? Or if they're persecuting their citizens, should another state be able to step in? And I think the consensus that they've come to is that in state failings and times of like humanitarian crises, state sovereignty is reduced and other states can step in. And that's where international proceedings come in, and like the UN can make decisions on that. So like in China right now, I think is a pretty timely example with the persecution of the Uyghur Muslims, that in that situation, the UN could potentially dictate, okay, well, in this case of genocide, we're allowing for other states to step in and resolve this issue or help resolve.
Yeah, I think it's really important to think about international law. And I think especially now when we have bodies like the United Nations, it's important for us to see that they're kind of dictating what just law is. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll talk about this more when we talk about Augustine, but I think it does something that this idea proceeds or comes from is some kind of dignity between all human people. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's important with international law. That recognition has to be there. Because otherwise, it's like, okay, why are we even thinking about when is it right to wage a war? Otherwise, we don't have to think about something like this. So, or at least some kind of recognition of, at least some recognition of humanity, that we should act in a certain way. This concept, though, of international law, and this is important because it will feed into medieval just war theory, it really goes back to the Roman Empire. When Rome is dealing with a lot of other states, they're recognizing, okay, we're not the only ones who have a legal code, and some people's legal codes are different than ours, but we have some similarities. And then a really important concept for them was treaties. how are we going to negotiate a treaty with a different state that has different laws than ours? We recognize our law, we recognize their law. Rome was really good about not necessarily implementing every single law that they had into their colonization. And so they came up with kind of, it's called the jus gentium, I think, the war of nations, the law of nations. And so this was supposed to be the idea that it was a kind of international law that connected not just Rome, not just Gaul, not just Persia or whatever. It regulated all of human beings. Every human being had some kind of shared dignity as long as they were humans. And so I think that's an important concept that gets us at least to the Middle Ages, because if we're recognizing that humans have some kind of rights and some dignity, if we're recognizing that, that will influence how we are thinking about not only what we can do to other peoples, but when is it okay for us to go invade other peoples? When does that make it right? This is an important question. Do y'all think, even though it seems silly, do you think this is an important concept for states to inherently recognize with each other?
Well, yeah. Humanity has a poor history of doing it, though. You know, sure. I mean, even with what we're talking about with the Roman Empire, you know, acknowledging that, you know, other peoples have different law codes and all that sort of stuff. Of course, the Romans were completely ruthless in how they treated others. And there is that particular question that we get to when we say others, right? Mm-hmm. When you talk about war, sometimes war can, in the ancient world, can be justified because those people are different than you. And this is why the word barbarian existed mm-hmm. in ancient Greece, because it was peoples who didn't speak Greek. And they said this sounded like their language was bar, 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 bar. And so they're called barbarians. And it's okay to like invade those people. So, you know, history is rife with groups not acknowledging the dignity of other groups. I think, though, today in our age, universally, I would say that is the ideal. And I think a lot of countries stick to that, at least outwardly. Of course, we know genocides happen all the time.
They are happening right now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A trend that we'll see, at least, I mean, just war theory does not just exist within the Western tradition. It's first noticed, there was a study done rather recently that tried to find the first culture that discussed just war theory to see how they acted and whatever. But these traditions go back to ancient Egypt, which I believe was the very, very mm-hmm. first one who kind of touched upon just war theory. But it also has a big tradition in China and, sure. you know, Eastern countries. And so I don't know too much about those. I know that in the Tao, it does discuss war. I don't know mm-hmm. if it discusses when is it acceptable for us to go to war.
It doesn't. It definitely, though, addresses how we should treat our approach to war. I remember, I can't remember which poem, but it says soldiers should treat war like a funeral.
Yes.
In other words, acknowledge that you're taking someone else's life. Mm. So yeah, there is that concept there. War should be observed like a funeral. Mm.
Okay, well, I guess we can skip a few, unless you want to jump in, Taylor, and I don't know what's going on until Augustine, but mm-hmm. I think he's a good place to start.
I know a little bit about what Thucydides and Plato write about war.
Yes.
That really interestingly, in the Republic, I think it's book 6, Plato says that it's completely justified to enslave barbarians when you conquer them, that because they're other people. But in the case of like inter-Greek city-state fighting, they should attempt mm-hmm. to resolve them peacefully and not fight with each other as much as they can, which I think is an interesting distinction that Socrates makes there, that outsiders should be fought with to the most extreme measures and they should be conquered, but people that are like us should be treated well. I don't know. I find that kind of peculiar.
I think that to understand Plato's point there, you have to be ingrained in his Republic. And I don't think mm-hmm. it's not necessarily Plato's racist who prefers his own people. I don't think that's necessarily necessarily true. I mean, maybe there's elements of that in there, but I think his point will be, if we had him here, I think he would say, okay, look, we have a concept of virtue that other cultures don't have. He knows this because he traveled after Socrates died. He traveled around the Mediterranean and met with a lot of peoples. If we don't have this very important concept of virtue that our city-state is not founded upon, that's going to lead to the destruction of our city-state, because our city-state, its entire concept for it to be very good is because it has some underlying concept of virtue. I think that is kind of what's important for Plato. He doesn't have necessarily some concept of dignity of all human beings. That's where it will not include.
And I know you're trying to segue us over to Augustine. I've got to bring this up. I was trying to find a place to bring in this quote, because we're talking about Greece. The Siege of Melos. Are you familiar with this?
I am.
It's such a great story. It's when the Athenians lay siege to Melos, and they give them this ultimatum: surrender and pay tribute or be destroyed. And there's this great quote that says, "The strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must. Yeah.
But for context for that, that was something that was very, very unpopular.
It was very controversial. It's true.
And it almost happened again. I don't know if you'll know this. It almost happened again.
It wasn't Alcibiades, was it?
I think it was the first time.
But
it almost happened again, and at the very end of the Peloponnesian War, but and they sent a ship to go do it, but there was a debate, and it ended up not happening. They caught them. They sent a ship to go find them and tell them not to do it, and that was really an example. Well, we it's not a good time to talk about it today, but that was really.
I'm sorry I brought it up.
No. It's good though. That was an example for the Greeks of when they didn't, when they were taken over.
Like we went too far
by demagogues. That was showing the power of bad state actors, basically.
Yeah, yeah, it's such a good quote. Augustine.
Yeah. So, but the fact that I think you paint something, it's important. We painted this big division between these people who wanted to recognize some commonalities between the people who they were not, but they kind of had trouble integrating that. Does that make sense? The Romans, they wanted to have some kind of method to negotiate after they had observed other concepts, had laws. That was important to them. But when we get to the Christian Empire, they do have this great Roman tradition of law and justice the importance of having a strong military and war, and that it's necessary for our own survival. I mean, this is just Roman tradition at this time. But also, we have to remember that now there's this new concept in Christianity that's kind of the head of the Roman Empire at the time, and that is that there's some kind of dignity to a human people, not just us, but also everyone in general. So what do we think about, do we think that this is... I don't know. What do we think about this? Let me rephrase this question, because it's bad. Why is it true post some kind of Christian or some kind of God that says every human has dignity? Why should we think that that's true?
Well, I mean, I have my answer, but I don't know what it's based in. I call it the spark of the divine argument, but then you kind of got to go with a panentheistic sort of viewpoint of religion. But yeah, it's that there's a spark of the divine in all of this, whatever you want to call that thing. When I say spark of the divine, whether or not you literally mean that in a sort of theistic way, or even in a properties or substance type of way, or whether it's sort of metaphorical, but it's, for me, it's the thing that acknowledges that there's something amongst all human beings. But there's also kind of a biological maybe explanation to that, is like, as we observe other things in nature, we see that human beings are unique. A unique group. You know, we don't look at a cat and be like, oh yes, a cat is like a human being. No, like we see other humans, and so there's some sort of tribal, if you will, I don't know if it's the right word, but some sort of tribalness to the fact that we are all humans, and therefore we share something, no matter the difference of our cultures.
I think that's interesting. What do you think, Taylor?
Well, personally, I think that regardless of like the religious background, or like the religious perspective you come from in terms of like justifying the belief that all humans have intrinsic value, and we don't necessarily need a religion to tell us that. But I think that Christianity is important to the historical context because the Bible says that all humans were made in the image of God, and it gives human life a more concrete divine justification, that we all have some sort of inherent purpose and there's a place that that value comes from. So it's easier to justify why we would value human life when we have something to back it up to.
I don't see why we have to, why we can even think that that's necessarily true if we don't have some kind of divine or at least kind of Platonist approach. I don't see why we would think that all humans have dignity. I don't know why that would be truth. I mean, that sounds like a nice concept, but I don't know.
You don't know? Wait.
Like if there's no God who says all humans have dignity, where there's no like form of what a good person is or whatever, I don't know why should I believe that person Y is on the same footing as me?
I don't know that I have a like justification for that. I just believe that all life has dignity, that life is valuable inherently.
I wonder how much of that is just like the your religious background, or
I don't know.
I'm curious. I've always been curious about this question, like post some kind of God. Why should we think that? I think it's an interesting philosophical question to think about, for sure. But I think this kind of natural law that's connecting humans, like you said, the Christians and Augustine think that all humans have some kind of natural dignity because they're all made in the image of God. Augustine's the person who coins just war, right? And so my understanding of what Augustine thought was that on the whole, Christians should by and large be pacifists. We should not want to engage in war. There's a quite high bar when we have to act. And there's some circumstances that we do have to act for Augustine, where getting into conflict, fighting a war is necessary. And so I think what Augustine says is like, if our life is in danger, or if our nation's in danger, or if some bigger sin will occur for us not being involved, then that's right for us to go to war.
That sounds along the lines of what he said. City of God, right?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
He coined this phrase in City of God. Yeah.
That sounds right.
I don't think he doesn't discuss it much, but he definitely discusses it. But I think his point in there was that, say that the Christian nation is being invaded, which I think it was around his time. It's being invaded by non-believers who want to stamp out Christian rule. In such a case, it would be acceptable for the use of force by the Christian nation or whoever to fight a war against them to preserve themselves, not only on an individual level, but just to preserve the faith, which they believe is good, in response or in conflict with something that's bad. So I think that there's this kind of internal good versus bad conflict. When there is good, we have to fight to preserve it. If it's in response to something that could stamp it out completely, or in defense of our own life or community.
Does Augustine address being the aggressor? In other words, you're starting the war. I get a self-defense sort of argument, but does he address that, like being the aggressor?
I believe there's no right place for being the aggressor in a war. But what does that necessarily mean? If a nation is, you know, for instance, like the 2003 Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever is making weapons of mass destruction, is that an acceptable time for us to go to war? I think if we really have, and I don't want to talk about, there's no evidence for that, whatever, in 2003, but say that there was substantial evidence that they were going to nuke us or whatever, I think in such a circumstance, that would be an acceptable time, even though they haven't necessarily attacked us yet. that threat or that planning to, I think that is an acceptable situation for us to punch back.
The military, they call that a preemptive strike. Yeah, I always think, I mean, this is making it simplistic, but it's kind of like it's a playground situation. He started it, and you're pointing at the other kid. And so if you're the person that starts it, right, because someone starts it, every war is instigated by some side. I always think that if you are going to be this aggressor, the person that starts it, for lack of a better term, it obviously has to be justified in some sort of way, which may maybe where like just war theory even began, to try to basically let yourself off the hook or let your country off the hook or whatever, because we have just reason or just cause to invade.
Yeah, and that's a really good point that you make. For this to be a really acceptable argument, I think there either needs to be some acceptance of natural law, or there needs to because there just needs to be some acceptance of natural law, I think. How else are you going to have I think you're getting at, how are we going to make a difference between what's just and what's not if we don't agree on natural law? And that's something that I have, I think, a problem with, honestly, with I think this is very difficult, just war, making a claim for it post natural law, believing in natural law. There's an Augustine quote, and I think this is in response to your question better. He says in the City of God, there's no wars undertaken by a good state except on behalf of good faith or for safety. Something there that, if you could see this quote, I think that sticks out to you, is that there's this emphasis on a good state. Mm-hmm. The state has to be good for it to be a just war.
Right. That's true.
And that's something we'll see with Aquinas. I think the important difference for Aquinas and Augustine, because Aquinas takes the Augustine mantle when he's thinking about just war, and a few other, you know, 100 monks or whatever who have written about it, who we've forgotten about. Aquinas solidifies a criteria for a war to be just. He says three criteria must be met for war to be just. And this is, I think, important for us to think about. First, the war must be commanded by someone who is just themselves. They have to be a virtuous person. They can't be a bad guy who's really good at war. Okay. And so for him, of course, that means a virtuous Christian.
Sure.
Secondly, the war needs to have a good reason for it to be waged. It has to be just. And for it to be just, it has to have necessarily been provoked. Okay. Some wrong must have been done to you for this war to be just. So it kind of needs to be an act of self-defense. And then finally, and I think this is the really interesting one, not only must the state be justified for it to be provoked and be led by a good king or whatever, or good general, the warriors also have to be just. They have to be those that will not only do good, but avoid evil.
Sure.
And this is like, this makes sense to me. This makes a lot of sense to me.
It's an awfully high bar.
Yeah, that's the point, though. It's a really high bar. And Aquinas' point. Yeah, go.
Yeah, I mean, so again, I'm thinking of the Crusades. Mm-hmm. And in Christendom, you had this idea of the noble knight. And we had the whole code of chivalry, and these are warriors of God and all this sort of stuff. Like in reality, what a knight was a brute. And we know that there are countless atrocities that were occurred in the First Crusade on the way to the Holy Lands. Multiple atrocities occurred.
Yeah, for sure.
And so when I say it's a high bar, especially like in the Middle Ages, I mean, God, what a brutal time anyway. Everyone was familiar with death. But today, this is why we have war crimes. That's why war crimes exist. So if you think of like Abu Ghraib prison, that horrible situation of those prisoners, those people were prosecuted for war crimes because like they were not acting virtuously, to put it mildly. So, you know, go back to the UN, which we talked about earlier, with this idea that you know, we should have virtuous warriors when we're having warfare. Well, I think it's kind of an admission that that's impossible, because if nothing more, we're humans and we're flawed. And, you know, there's something called the fog of war, which is once you get into a battle, like man, all those, not that I know anything about it, but all that just goes out the window. And this is why there's such an emphasis on war crimes, prosecute those in an attempt mm-hmm. to, like all law does, is to try to keep people in line when we begin acting towards our worst tendencies. No. Just thinking about all that.
No, it's a good point. It's a good point. I think that there shouldn't be, but I think if there's a criteria for just war, I think that bar needs to be high.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, Aquinas isn't wrong. I'm just saying this is what happens.
But
yeah. Well, similar to how Mr. Parsons goes back to the Crusades, I think about Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War, because in a lot of ways, the Peloponnesian War reflects a lot of wars that follow after it in terms of like the Thucydides trap, where the growth of a rising power inspires fear in an established power. And so the established power attacks them. And in terms of Aquinas's criteria, I wonder which of those conflicts would have been justified in beginning. If like, how high does the threat have to be before it's justified? But then again, like Athens and Sparta committed so many atrocities in the war that just horrible, horrific crimes, that those could have never been justified, but could the beginning of the war be justified in some ways? And you see this play out in the debate in Sparta with King Archidamus arguing, no, we shouldn't fight. That's like unjust and it's bad for us. The odds that we win this are really low, so we shouldn't fight them. Just, I don't know, interesting thought to think about.
Yeah. Before Andrew jumps in, I just want to say, like, I think this is great that you keep bringing up the Peloponnesian War, because it was such an example for Rome and future generations that came. It was the first great history written about a war, and in the way that Thucydides wrote it. No, it's something that like generals and emperors and everyone studied, which is why it's such a great piece to reference when we talk about warfare.
I mean, it's a pressing concept even now. This is, I mean, mm-hmm. the United States and China, this is a Thucydidean trap by George Elias, one of the past secretaries of state.
James Mattis. Well, he may have been defense, but he was also...
Yeah. Well, that goes to the point too. I mean, this is a very common thing that people study, especially, mm-hmm. I mean, like in military academies around the world.
Yeah.
This is a big thing. Like they study this Peloponnesian War. To the question of were any of these wars justified in the sense of what Aquinas's criteria would say? Probably not. I highly doubt it. And I think that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think that's the point. I wonder how many wars would occur if it was thought of in Aquinas's criteria for just wars.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. And there's even a question, I think, of can you be a virtuous or a just military leader in war? It seems like at some point you'll be called to make some very questionable decisions. And I think there have certainly been more virtuous or noble leaders, military leaders, than others. I think of Eisenhower as a good example of a virtuous person, but we can find lots of problems with Eisenhower too. But there are certainly like MacArthur. MacArthur was dishonorably discharged, even though he's a great general in World War II from the Korean War. You know, so yeah, I just think it's appropriately a high bar.
Mm-hmm.
You should most definitely have the most virtuous people you can imagine leading a war. But again, the nature of war just calls for there's so many gray areas. You know.
Yeah. What is it? Like even in this Ukraine war right now with Russia, as much as Ukraine's justified in fighting back, I think it's very difficult to find a just war where both actors are completely justified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And we can talk about different types of munitions that are being used and the way that they're being used by both sides and lots of finger pointing. And yeah, the bottom line is just really hard to have a just war.
Yeah.
Yeah. You start talking about civilian casualties and accidents and geez.
But I mean, I don't know if that's like, would a power ever do this? Would a power ever constrain themselves to fighting a just war? Probably not.
If the historical pattern has any say, probably not.
I mean, at the end of the day, you got to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, your virtue doesn't do your country a lot of good if you...
No, if you can't have virtue.
Losing the war mm-hmm. and your country is... Yeah.
It's like this Oppenheimer movie that I thoroughly enjoyed more than the Barbie movie. One of the questions that they talked about it a little bit is dropping these bombs on Japan. Is this justified?
Right. Because
they calculated 5 million Americans would die if they invaded Japan and wouldn't give
mm-hmm.
up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but this even goes down to questions. Just war theory, we've talked a lot about it on, we haven't talked a lot about what kind of rules in war are appropriate once war has begun. We haven't talked mm-hmm. about, like, is it okay to use nuclear weapons? Is it okay to use, like, those, what is it, orange bombs or whatever?
Agent Orange?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Or these cluster bombs that they've been talking about, the Ukraine-Russian war. Yeah.
Or, like, you know, flamethrowers.
God. Can you imagine? What a horrible mm-hmm. way to die. I've even known that, I don't know how I know this, but it's a war crime if you use a 50 caliber gun on a human being. Now you can use 50 cal. Mm-hmm. Those are the big ones that are mounted on Jeeps and stuff.
Bullets are about this big.
Yeah, they're huge. Like, that'll just rip a human apart. Yeah. But, you know, use it on a tank or a Jeep or an aircraft, and that's okay. So, you know, the rules of war are very, very interesting. They're important, but yeah, it's just, yeah, it's like the conduct of war.
Mm-hmm.
It's wild. I don't know much of this. We tried to have this. I don't know. I'm just very, very curious, independent of natural law. Why do we think this is true and why should we follow it?
Because, I don't have a justification for my answer, but I think at the end of the day, we all realize that there has to be some humanity, even in war. You can't bomb civilians, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know why that's
although we do
yeah
but maybe that's why it exists, is because we do recognize, like, there's got to be some humanity
we recognize ourselves and others.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough topic,
and we
picked a real good one for our first for our first video,
for our first YouTube episode.
Yeah. This is a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think this is time to call it. Unfortunately, we could talk a lot more about it, as always.
That's right. Guys, feel free to continue the conversation, but I'll just say thank you for listening, everyone, today. We always appreciate that you do. Taylor?
Yeah. And if you have any comments or questions for us, please let us know either on Instagram at Open Door Philosophy or on our email, contact@opendoorphilosophy.com. And if you want your question featured in an episode, please let us know. Otherwise, we can just get back to you.
Yeah, and also corrections. If you have any corrections for us, mm-hmm. I bet we got lots wrong. I bet I got lots wrong with this episode.
Me too.
Me talking about 50 caliber guns.
Yeah, and I guess this will probably be up on YouTube, but no promises about that. So if you like this and you're listening and you want to support the channel in multiple ways, you can go ahead and subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a like. That will help us out too. Yeah. Anyways, I think that's it, guys.
That's it. Read us out.
That's all.
Yeah. And remember, if your life's in need of some philosophy, the door is always open. See you next week.
All right. See you.
Weeks.
Bye.
Bye.